No woman could or would ever fuck things up like this. So to get around a lot of this, I decided to worship the sun. But as I said, I don't pray to the sun. You know who I pray to? Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci. Two reasons. First of all, I think he's a good actor, okay? To me, that counts. Second, he looks like a guy who can get things done. Joe Pesci doesn't fuck around. In fact, Joe Pesci came through on a couple of things that God was having trouble with. For years, I asked God to do something about my noisy neighbor with the barking dog. Joe Pesci straightened that cocksucker out with one visit. There is no God. None, not one, no God, never was. In fact, I'm gonna put it this way. If there is a God, may he strike this audience dead. See, nothing happened. Nothing happened. Everybody's okay. All right, tell you what. I'll raise the stakes a little bit. If there is a God, may he strike me dead. See, nothing happened. Oh, wait, got a little cramp in my leg. And my balls hurt. Plus, I'm blind. Oh, now I'm okay again. Must have been Joe Pesci, huh?
Thank you, George Carlin. My name is Paul Holden-Graeber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library. As many of you know, my goal here at the library is quite simple, to make the lions roar, to make patience and fortitude roar. My department, as I said, is called Live from the New York Public Library. I once had the great pleasure of featuring an event on obituaries called Dead from the New York Public Library, where I had half of the undertakers of the New York Times present. I was interested to learn that our MC tonight, Whoopi Goldberg, began her career working in a funeral parlor. I would love to know more about that part of her life. It is a great honor for us to pay tribute here at the library to George Carlin. No better place, I believe, in the world could have a tribute to George Carlin, a man for whom words mattered so much, a man who was absolutely never pusillanimous and always pungent with his words. Whoopi Goldberg and others will introduce you to our wonderful cast of characters who are, in order of appearance, Jerry Stiller and Anne Meara, who will be joined on stage by Ben and Amy Stiller, Louis Lapham, Kevin Smith, Dylan Brody, Kelly Carlin, Tony Hendra, Patrick Carlin, Floyd Abrams, and Louis C.K. The impetus for tonight was Tony Hendra's book, which he co-wrote with George Carlin, or the other way around, I'm not sure. Perhaps Tony will explain. The book, which is wonderful, is fittingly entitled Last Words. From the bottom of my heart, I would like to thank Tony Hendra and Kelly Carlin for all the work and passion they put into making this evening possible. Please stand and please join me in thanking them. You need not stand again, though I would love you to stand again, because I would also like to thank my entire team who helped put this together with me, and first and foremost, my Live from the New York Public Library producer, Meg Stemler. I now leave you in the perfect company of Whoopi Goldberg, encouraging you first to become supporters and friends of the New York Public Library. For just $40 a year, you can become a friend of the New York Public Library. If you ask me, that's a cheap date. Encouraging you to learn more about our live programs. For instance, next week we have David Remnick in conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates discussing Barack Obama and race. George Prochnick speaking about the importance of silence in a noisy world. We intend to start the evening with at least one moment or 1 minute of silence. Read the announcement about that evening in particular. It really is quite fascinating to find out how shrimps or elephants hear. Come here, Patti Smith, who I will be interviewing, Peter Carey, who Edmund White will talk to. And in June, I will be entertaining myself with John Waters, as well as Christopher Hitchens, who is publishing his memoirs now. That's something I think quite interesting, and his memoir is called Hitch 22. We also have an extraordinary evening lined up with the photographer Lena Herzog. We end the season with an event on the World Cup, yes, on soccer. So stay tuned for that. Join our email list and you will remain, as they say, au courant. And now, ladies and gentlemen, hosting not the Oscars, but better yet, a live from the New York Public Library event, It Doesn't Get Better, is Whoopi Goldberg in the tribute to the late and great George Carlin.
First, thank you for that really interesting introduction. It was a little PBS-like, but I'm glad. I'm surprised you don't have an evening about curling. But now that I've suggested it, I'm sure you'll get the curling experts to come up and help us out with shit like that. I'm going to briefly just give you a little of me about George Carlin. I, for some reason, have had George Carlin in my life since I was little. My mother introduced me to him. She woke me out of a dead sleep to come see him on some show. And from then on, it was love. It was love and understanding that if he could walk such a funny line, that it might be possible for me. And then she really messed me up and showed me Richard Pryor, and so you see what happened. But those two men, along with a woman called Toadie Fields, were instrumental in forming a lot of my style of comedy, which is a little bit out there, I know, for most people. And tonight is particularly wonderful after Joe Biden said fuck and everybody lost their mind. See, George would totally understand it, but apparently people were losing their minds. Oh my God, that vice president said fuck. Let us not forget that Dick Cheney said fuck off to somebody in the chamber. So I don't think it was as bad, but you know, fuck exists all through our nation, and I'm proud to say that I'm a fan of fuck. Having said that, let me begin the evening. Jerry Stilla and Ann Mira, we are honored to kick off this tribute with these two folks who have themselves made huge, insanely great contributions to comedy, both as legendary comedians and apparently as the parents, because I keep forgetting, of two very seriously funny kids, Jerry Stilla and Ann Mira. Those are not the kids, but they'll introduce their children. Please come up, Jerry and Ann.
Is this just for me to hold? No, it's on. Okay. What were those pictures we saw being drawn before? Does anyone know? Is it like a code thing? Secret? Speak up, I can't hear you. Okay. We're not here because of the drawings, are we? We're here for George and for Kelly and Patrick. And it's been wonderful for us to have crossed paths with George, even though we're older. You know that.
Yes, I know, understand. Listen, I just have to tell you, I'm not very... I really feel very... do I have a mic on? I don't think so. I just wanted to say I hate memorials because, to tell you the truth, I'm not feeling too hot myself. but I have to tell you about why... I can talk for myself at this moment because...
You can talk for me.
And for both of us. And I have to say that I went to college, and there was a teacher... who talked about a man named Joseph Talma. Talma was a theorist, a drama critic, and he had a theory about actors. He said
Are you going to remember this?
No. So here's what he said. Superior intelligence makes for middling actors, and middling intelligence makes for superior actors. And I thought he was
that
applying...
That was a drug addict.
No. Of course, that did not apply to George Carlin, who was both superior in intellect and also a wonderful actor. I once had a conversation with George. I said to him, George, have you ever aspired to be on Broadway? Well, you could have been a great Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. You could have played Hickey in Iceman Cometh. I mean, he said, no, he said, Jerry, I'll tell you the truth. Are you drinking? No. He said, no, Jerry. He said, you know, if I had a chance to play Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, he said, I would have had to hide behind the character written by Arthur Miller. And I really would much rather play myself, where there's nobody else to hide behind. And that, I thought, was profound. And I still think it does, because it's from that moment on, it launched all the other comics who came out of this place that started doing themselves. But that's all I have to say, because we got a long evening ahead of us.
Okay, fine. Jerry, thank you for that heartfelt thing. I think we're supposed to have Amy and Ben come up with us, but I wanted to read you a letter first. Should I read that first? Yeah? Is that Tony? Oh, Tony is speaking. I know it was Tony. You really can drop the accent. You've been here 40 fucking years. I mean, it's affected. I was going and I was looking for correspondence, and Jody Eisenstein and Dawn Eaton, they found this letter that was sent to us, an email, and I thought we'd split it up and read it. And if it's too long, I'll just cut off to the thing, whatever. And it's from George. And it was...
dated January 9th, 2006.
Okay.
I feel like and, that woman on the Good Morning Joe character. What's her name? The woman who was the daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Mika! I can't stand her. She's a fake liberal. What a piece of caca. Come on. The guy she's working with. Ask him about the woman who worked in his office, Mr. Scarborough, who's dead. I check the internet. I believe every conspiracy theory there is. Here's George's email, a group email, not just to me and Jerry, but to his friends. And he says, hi, fucks. Sorry, folks. There's a difference. It's small, but it's there. I know a lot of you don't like mass emailings. Well, tough shit. This is the easiest way for me to tell all of you the following wonderful Christmas tale. December 27th was my first AA birthday. 1 year sober. By now it's a year and 12 days. Good for me. I celebrated that birthday in the hospital with congestive heart failure and pneumonia. I spent 8 days in there, Christmas Eve through New Year's Day. It was a bit of a struggle, but what the fuck? I had nothing to do but get well.
You take it down.
I went in, I was so short of breath, I couldn't walk 50 feet without beginning to breathe, and walking up a flight of stairs required a few minutes of recovering and regaining my breath. It's all part of congestive heart failure, which is a condition, not an event. There are degrees of heart failure. It's an unfortunately named condition. It sounds so final, but it is a condition. With its ages and stages, it's not an event. It doesn't mean your heart stopped. On with you.
Okay. Hospital stays are little more than a series of insults, injuries, inconveniences, and indignities. But if you're lucky and you get out safely without one of those hospital-spawned drug-resistant viral infections, they can get you help. They can get help. Did I read that right?
Yeah, it's a misspelling.
Oh, okay. They can get help. You can get well, or at least they can keep an eye on you as you get well. Go, go, go.
Being hooked.
Aren't we cute how we work together?
This is like sex in a strange way, but I want to tell you something.
But the closest we're going to get to it, I'll tell you.
Secrets of the damned.
That's good.
Thank you very much. I get congratulated once in a while. I may get lucky tonight. Who the hell knows? Well, thank you, George Carlin, for that. Anyway, being hooked up to monitors is terribly restrictive. You can't reach far enough to get things off your table, and you can't twist around for any reason if you do. You pull the monitor leads, which are attached to a whole lot of hairs on your chest. Yeah, so when you stretch or twist around, you pull a whole lot of hairs. That's the funny part of George. He pulls a whole lot of hairs. I don't like that among the many.
Okay. Daily IVs and blood draws also involve tape being placed on hairy areas and later removed either slowly or savagely. Either way, it hurts. Fuck you. It hurts. I'd rather have a spear lodged squarely in my neck than to have 30 or 40 of my hairs pulled all at once. I finally taught all the nurses about the little adhesive remover pads that were hidden deeply away in their supply closet. Then I got hold of a small supply of my own, and from then on, I removed the tapes myself.
In the hospital, only a few nurses speak enough English for you to be able to speak to them without any sort of nuance. By the way, if you ever check in a hospital, take a course in Tagalog first. The reason the Philippines are losing population can be traced directly to America's hospital manpower needs, at least on this West Coast hospital.
When I was in there, I got another angioplasty done, and they placed a double stent in my right circumflex coronary artery. Is that true, Kelly? Yes. Is he not making up these words?
No. Okay. Ask me. I got one myself. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, at least I'm not having any symptoms that would indicate otherwise. It's healing well, and so am I generally. I've been home now for a week, and I feel a lot better, though there is a way to go yet. 8 days in a hospital bed is its own physical insult, and you need to regain strength from that alone. Your turn.
I am improving and getting stronger and breathing easier. Still a way to go, but I'm getting there. By the way, my Christmas present to myself was cutting my annual show schedule from 150 nights to just 80 nights. I did it by eliminating all Las Vegas appearances. God, I hate that fucking place. The audiences are bone dumb. How about that, Steve? Bone fucking dumb. Eliminating those 10 weeks of torture will eliminate a great, great deal of stress in my life. Believe me, a great deal of stress will disappear just like that. Free at last. Free at last. Great God Almighty, free at last.
And it's signed yours forever, Big George from the Coast. P.S., no need to reply unless you need medical advice.
George Carlin.
Amy and Ben, why don't you join us?
Yeah, listen, this is the part of the show where Albino Ray brings on the King sisters. Oh, you do remember, right? Here they are, Ben and Amy. Had to put up with a lot of Mr. Goss in their life. Where are you?
Hi.
Do we want to? I don't want to get deep here. We already did that, right?
Hey, love the sex bit. That was
good. Yeah, that's really reassuring. That's fun. But
I hope you get lucky. I hope you get lucky.
He hopes you get lucky tonight.
It is disgusting, yeah.
Welcome to our world. Thank you. So, I know George through Kelly, who's a friend of mine. And, when I think of George Carlin, I think of heart. And I think he had an ability to reach people intimately in mass groups. So whether you were, watching him on HBO or you were in a club, you felt like you knew him. And I think that was his gift. But what I loved was his absurdity and the way he was able to, talk about huge issues and injustice, but then just sort of poke fun at the, just our own narcissism and stuff like that. That's what I relate to most of all.
Yeah, I just want to say, because there's a lot of people who are going to talk, but for me, George Carlin was, he was one of the comedy gods. He, right up there, and it was like Robert Klein and George Carlin, and then Steve Martin, Bill Murray, Albert Brooks, these guys were the guys. And I was lucky enough to get a chance to work with him in one of the first jobs I ever had, which was a shitty Fox movie of the week called Working Trash, where George and I, in 1990, I think, where we played janitors.
I remember the picture, you were both wearing janitor suits.
We worked in a building where we were janitors, and there was a stock market firm, and we tried to beat the stock market. And it was me and George, and George Wallace, the comedian, and Buddy Ebsen.
Oh, my God.
Buddy Ebsen. I worked with Buddy Ebsen. It sucked because...
Very popular... dancing comedian, played the Capitol Theater 1942 with June Allison and Catherine Grayson on stage with that girl who did twists and turns.
Yes.
It was a wonderful...
Anyway,
go ahead.
Sorry, okay.
I want to make it referential here. I want people to understand.
Where were you at the Buddy
Ebsen? This is a new reality show, right here.
I stayed for two shows at the Capitol that day.
Nobody cares.
The movie was Back to Bataan with Robert Walker. What a...
Mind like a steel trap.
Over
here. No, I just wanted... Anyway, it was the thing sucked, but it was because he didn't write it.
No.
And, George Carlin was about his mind and his words, but it was an opportunity for me to actually get a chance to meet one of my idols, and he was incredibly kind and warm-hearted, and I just want to say it was, it was just an incredible honor to even meet him ever. And I'm on Twitter, and... Yeah, I'm cool. And somebody tweeted a George Carlinism, which I thought was great, which is Frisbeterianism, is the belief that when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and gets stuck. That's great. And then another George Carlin, one last thing, is George Carlin had a bit about golf courses. He hated golf courses, and he thought that all homeless people should be taken to golf courses to live. And you know what? That's exactly what's happening in Haiti right now.
That's true.
And he called it. George Carlin was a genius, and that's all I want to say. Thank you.
And we're happy to be included, and we thank Tony Hender. We thank Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly.
Kelly Carlin McCall.
Thank you, Tom.
And I wished I had known Mary, your mom, Patrick. I wish I'd known her. And the only nice thing I can say about the Catholic Church is it gave birth to George, and he promptly left. Thank you.
Sex thing freaked me out too.
For over 30 years, Louis Latham edited the venerable literary magazine Harper's. He is one of America's leading essayists and founder and editor of Latham's Quarterly. As it turns out, he's also a huge George Carlin fan. Please welcome Louis Latham. Thank you.
When I see and listen to George Carlin, I think of him placing the ferocity of his wit at the service of his conscience, pitting it against what Mark Twain called the peacock shams of the world's colossal humbug. Twain construed satire as a crime of arson, a torch of words tossed into the hospitality tents of pompous and self-righteous cant. So also George Carlin, who, to the best of my knowledge and recollection, belongs within the tradition of American descent, in which is to be found the work of Ambrose Bierce, H.L. Mencken, Philip Wiley, Finley Peter Dunne, Dawn Powell, Sinclair Lewis, Terry Southern, Richard Pryor, Lenny Bruce, Albert J. Nock, Kurt Vonnegut, and Tom Paine. Carlin was a comedian, but his purpose was dissent, his standing up to say, no, we do not agree. Reminding people that in a free society, we can't know what we're about or whether we're telling ourselves too many lies unless we can see and hear one another think out loud. The thinking out loud was the bone and marrow of Carlin's art. What distinguishes his performances from the comedy routines that set up easy jokes in the shooting galleries of stale cliché. Knowing that liberty has ambitious and devoted enemies, Carlin, like Twain and Bierce and Lenny Bruce, also knew that the survival of the American democracy depends less on the size of its armies than on the capacity of its individual citizens to rely, if only momentarily, on the strength of their own minds. He sent his humor on a moral errand, what Twain called painted fire, intended to preserve his fellow Americans from being shriveled into sheep. The enterprise has become increasingly rare and therefore increasingly valuable during the latter half of the century, denominated by Time magazine as America's own. The pretensions to world empire, joined with the triumph of network television, have boomed the production of shriveled sheep and seriously depleted the capacity of individual citizens willing to think, if only momentarily, for themselves. The Cold War served to instill the habits of fearful obedience to inhibit any sudden movement of the dissenting spirit. Network television is, as Carlin well knew, made by a machine and meant to sell you stuff and keep you quiet. Something to be seen and not heard. The picture of a thought, not the thought itself. Carlin preferred live performance on the road for as many as 150 nights a year, because in the theater, words have consequence and one can hear what is being said. Words were important to Carlin. Words, he said, are all we have, really. Not only the heavy seven words that can't be heard on television, the ones that infect your mind and keep your country from winning the war, but the 400,000 other words in the English language that, when well and truly used, attack pride, victorious, and evil arrogant, and add to the common store of human energy and hope. In the 1980s, the thrust of American humor reversed direction. Jokes that once favored the least fortunate members of the society at the expense of their selfish and self-important overlords turned into merry witticisms, playing on the anxiety of the happy few confronted with scary apparitions from the lower depths, worried about ragged street persons and ugly dogs and angry hotel clerks, wondering how to kill a rat with an oboe, how to turn unbearable pain into extra income, what to wear on the toilet. Carlin didn't take the bait. The strength of his comedy is his standing up to the fact of the society as it really is, not as it is advertised by NBC and MasterCard. He didn't stoop to malicious gossip about wayward celebrity and malformed political abstraction, to the freeze-dried soundbites dropped into boiling water by Rush Limbaugh and Keith Olbermann. His humor is counterpoint to the tragedy of the human predicament, in which, as you will see from the following clip, he was careful to include himself.
I'm not one of these people who's worried about everything. You got these people around you. The country's full of them now. People walking around all day long, worried about everything. Worried about the air, worried about the water, worried about the soil. Worried about pesticides, insecticides, food additives, carcinogens, worried about radon gas, worried about asbestos. Worried about saving endangered species. Let me tell you about endangered species, all right? Saving endangered species is just one more arrogant attempt by humans to control nature. It is arrogant meddling. It's what got us in trouble in the first place. Doesn't anybody understand that? Interfering with nature. Over 90%, way over 90% of all the species that have ever lived on this planet, ever lived, are gone. They're extinct. We didn't kill them all. They just disappeared. That's what nature does. They disappear these days at the rate of 25 a day, regardless of our behavior, I mean. Irrespective of how we act on this planet, 25 species that were here today will be gone tomorrow. Let them go gracefully. Leave nature alone. Haven't we done enough? We're so self-important. So self-important. Everybody's going to save something now. I'll save the trees, save the bees, save the whales, save those snails. And the greatest arrogance of all, save the planet. What? Are these fucking people kidding me? Save the planet? We don't know how to take care of ourselves yet. We haven't learned how to help one another. We're going to save the fucking planet? I am getting tired of that shit. Besides, there's nothing wrong with the planet. The planet is fine. The people are fucked. The people are fucked. Compared to the people, the planet is doing great. The planet has been here for 4.5 billion years, all right? 4.5 billion. We've been here, what, 100,000? Maybe. 200,000? Maybe. And we've only been engaged in heavy industry for a little over 200 years. 200 years versus 4.5 billion. And we have the conceit to think that somehow we're a threat? That somehow we're going to put in jeopardy this beautiful little blue-green ball that's just floating around the sun? Planet has been through a lot worse than us for a long time. Been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles, bombardments for hundreds of thousands of years by comets and asteroids and meteors, sandstorms, erosion of all kinds, cosmic radiation, worldwide fires, worldwide floods, recurring ice ages. And we think some aluminum cans and some plastic bags are going to make a difference? Planet isn't going anywhere. We are. We're going away. We're going away. Pack your shit, folks. We're going away. And we won't leave much of a trace either. Thank God for that. Maybe a little styrofoam. Maybe a little styrofoam. Planet will be here and we'll be long gone. Just another failed mutation. Just another closed-end biological mistake. An evolutionary cul-de-sac. Planet will shake us off like a bad case of fleas. A surface nuisance. You want to know how the planet's doing? Ask those people in Pompeii who are frozen into position from volcanic ash. How the planet's doing. Well, no, if the planet's all right, ask the people in Mexico City or Armenia or 100 other places buried under thousands of tons of earthquake rubble if they feel like a real threat to the planet this week. How about the people in Kilauea, Hawaii, who build their homes right next to an active volcano and then wonder why they have lava in the living room? planet is going to be here a long, long, long time after we're gone, and it will heal itself, it will cleanse itself, because that's what it does. It's a self-correcting system. The air and the water will recover, the earth will be renewed. And say, if it's true that plastic doesn't degrade, well, the planet will simply incorporate plastic into a new paradigm, the earth plus plastic. The planet doesn't share our prejudice towards plastic. Plastic came out of the Earth. The Earth probably sees plastic as just another one of its children. Could be the only reason the Earth allowed us to be spawned from it in the first place. It wanted plastic for itself. Didn't know how to make it. Needed us. Could be the answer to our age-old philosophical question, why are we here? Plastic. Assholes.
The gentleman who spoke before this started, if I croak before you do, will you, like, come talk about me? Because you're as deep as they come, baby. Love town. Anyway, that classic essay is also the favorite Carlin piece of our next guest. Screenwriter, director, producer, comic book writer, author, comedian, actor. You know, Kevin Smith is well-rounded. He just does everything. And he bucks no shit from anybody, and I love him for that. Please welcome Kevin Smith.
You'll have to excuse me, I got real nervous at the beginning of the thing when I first sat down because I'm not a bright individual. And I saw the empty chair up here and it took me about half the show to figure out this is meant to represent George. I thought it was a test of some sort. And I thought if I didn't fit in the chair, well, I'd be asked to leave. And maybe it's just me, but I heard whispers of too fat to eulogize. But fuck those people, I'm here for George. Ladies and gentlemen, George Carlin gave me everything that I have in life as an adult, professionally and personally. I'm going to try to get through this, bear with me. When I was a kid, I grew up with very Catholic parents, confused Catholic parents. They were pretty, they believed in religion unless it cost a lot. And they proved this by when I was a kid, they would take me to, like, Disney World, my brother and sister. And while I was there, I'd go into a gift shop like most kids and be like, can I get this? And they'd be like, yeah, take it outside. We'll pay for it. And I would do that. I'd take a rubber snake outside, and I owned a rubber snake from the Jungle Cruise or you know, a Goofy toy or something like that. And soon they were just following me out of the store, not paying for it as they said they would when I left. And I said, what are you guys doing? They're like, we're going to send a check back to Mr. Disney when we get home. And so I was like, right on, right on. Wow, what a great system and great country this is. And Walt Disney's a generous, kind man. It wasn't until years later I was talking to my brother and sister, and I was just like, wouldn't it be great if we went back to Disney World and we could just get stuff again, and then Mom and Dad send a check back to Disney World like they did. And my brother and sister looked at me like I was like, just, Kevin, you're 28. Do you really not understand what happened back then? I said, no. And they said, they weren't paying for that. They were just telling you to take it and go because they thought Disney was overpriced. That's why you could have Mickey Mouse ears, but you couldn't have your name in it. And I was just like, all right, I get it. So they're fucking crooks. And they made me an accomplice. But it was weird because we were Catholic, and that was the family household that we had. The night that I watched Carlin at Carnegie, I was absolutely reborn. And it was a defining moment in my household. My father had always been about comedy and feeding me Red Fox records and George Carlin records and stuff like that. And I'd never seen him perform. He was going to be on HBO. My mother was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. He curses a lot. My father was like, don't worry. It's just bad language. George opens with a wonderful ditty that kind of split my parents in two. And it was, have you ever noticed that the people who are against abortion are people you wouldn't want to fuck in the first place? Now, my father was cracking up. My mother was looking sternly at my father, and I was like, what's abortion? And she was like, great, Don, great. You tell him what abortion is, and left the room. And when she came back 20 minutes later, George was probably, maybe 30 minutes, George was into the Rice Krispies bit. And suddenly the same woman who was had such a reaction to that joke that my father laughed at, but she did not, was like getting into the Rice Krispies bit, man. And I appreciated that. Suddenly I got it. This was a man who could work intelligently, and he could work for stupid people, like Mom. And because of that, I was like, that's what I would like to do. I would like to do that with my whole life, be able to just be up there, say things, and have people listen and I don't know, express yourself. He seemed to do it so effortlessly. And I looked at the man on TV, and I just wanted so much to be him. Everything about him I looked up to. I was like, my God, he's so funny, and he's so smart, and he's so thin, and I'd like to... Maybe I could be that. He was just the guy that I wanted to be. I spent most of my life trying to be George Carlin. One day I made a movie and boom, my career started. And that movie is full of potty mouth language, very, very potty mouth language. And one critic in the world compared it to George Carlin, and quietly I was like, anyway. Years later, I had the opportunity. I finally had a Carlin-worthy piece of material that I felt like I could approach the legend with, because this man, again, gave me everything. I'm married today because I made a movie that got me some money, and I paid some broad, and we got married. You know, I mean, that's... bought a kid in the process. You know, just to, so people wouldn't be like, you loser. I'd be like, look. So for me, when I got the first opportunity to kind of be like, oh, I'm going to get George Carlin in a movie, it was this movie I made called Dogma that I wrote, and I gave it to George because it was so up George's alley and in his wheelhouse. First time we worked together, it was amazing, but he was not the dude who would just sit there and try to make you laugh. You could have a real conversation with George. He didn't just turn it on and be like, okay, you're standing in front of George Carlin, I'm going to make you laugh. He just sit there and talk about boring shit. To be honest with you, George never really tried to make me laugh in person. I loved him for it, because I just wanted to sit there and listen to him talk about normal things, because I could see him be funny on TV. But I loved him so much, I would keep trying to bring him back, and I brought him back for the second movie called Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And this is where I learned what an actor George Carlin was, and how important acting was to him. Because I just assumed, he's a comic, and he likes being on stage, and he's a brilliant comic at it and whatnot, so that's all he needs. George always wanted to act and whatnot, and I found it out while we were making, of all movies, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. He's got a scene where he plays a hitchhiker, where all essentially he has to do is blow some dude in a truck. And he was so flattered that I called him. And... So he did it, we shot, and George, like, between takes, he was just like, okay, the joke was like, this guy is talking about the rules of the road and whatnot, and George goes, okay, well, let me understand, do I believe in the rules of the road? And I was like, George, the picture's called Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Don't think too much, just go like that, you know, and that was it. But acting was important. Understanding the motivation of the character was so important to him. And so he came back the next time, he's like, I don't know if I'm feeling it, and I was just like, You believe in the rules of the road, George. You this is what you believe in your heart. And he's like, thank you. And he went out there and gave a convincing, very convincing, wide-eyed, cock-sucking performance, you know? When we were done with it, I went back to the van with him because we shot really far out. We were driving back to base camp, and I'm sitting with him in the van. I said, how'd you like it? He said, I had a good time. I was so glad I was able to make it out because, as mentioned, Jude was always on a stage somewhere. So I said, I can't thank you enough for coming out. It's really hysterical shit. What can I do for you, man? I mean, I know you broke us off the time. He goes, Kevin, don't mention it. If you just do me a favor, you're going to do anything for me, just write me my dream role for acting. I said, what would that be? And he goes, I want to play a clergyman who strangles 6 children. And I said, George, we already made our religious picture. And he goes, well, let's do another one. I said, if I can, I'll get back to you. And so I wrote this movie called Jersey Girl, which nobody liked. But George... very much. And I sent George the script, and I'd written a lead role for him to play Ben Affleck's father. I sent him the script, cover letter, George, this is the part I want you to play. I know it's a real big part, but I think you could do it. And he calls me about a day after he read it. I said, how you doing? What'd you think? And he goes, well, there's a kid in it, but I don't fucking strangle her. And I can't help but think it would have been so much better for my career if I had let him strangle that little girl. But it didn't matter, man, because he fucking loved acting. That's the thing probably a lot of people didn't know about George. You see him in his element. You watch him in clips, and he's a brilliant master at it. But, my God, he loved acting so much. That's what he wanted to do most in life, was be an actor. He would say that on set. He was like, I love doing this, man. This is what I always wanted to do. I was like, really? This? He's like, well, maybe not this movie particularly, but good movies in general and whatnot. So for me, I was like, you got to be involved in this. He came out and treated it so fucking seriously, man. So seriously, gave it his all and whatnot. Because he felt, he told me, he's like, this is the moment I've been waiting for my whole life, to show people that I can, like, be somebody that's not the comic. Just inhabit a character. This is a salt of the earth guy. I could totally get my head around it. And he would get his head around it in weird, wild ways. He'd come up to me and be like, Kevin, we're in the middle of rehearsals. Me, Ben Affleck, and him. We're about to start. An hour later, other people come. It's just the three of us. He goes, Kevin, I just want you to know there's a character in the movie named Greeny that I'm always fighting with. I said, I know, I wrote it, George. He goes, all right, well, the thing is, what's not there on the page is, and you never say why I'm always fighting with Greeny, but, like, what I want you to know is I've come up with a backstory for myself about why I fight with Greeny all the time, and I wrote it down, and I committed it to memory, and I've since thrown it out. It'll never come up in your movie, but I want you to know that if you need me to reference something, I'm going to pull it, and that's where the words are going to come from. And I turned to Affleck. I was like, why can't you ever be this fucking good, man? And he was absolutely devoted to the craft, and we tried so desperately to get him into the last flick that we made while he was around, which is Zach and Mary. But again, his touring schedule was really weird. And I remember one of the last conversation I actually had with him was while we were in the midst of making Zach and Mary, and he was telling me he wasn't going to be able to make it out to play this one-day role, and he was just like, you know what, Kevin, don't worry about it. I'll see you on the next one. And that was that. So he's not here, and my God, I miss him so much, and I can't ever say that, like, we were close friends or something like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of these people come up, talk about him, like, I knew George when I worked with him, but he made everything possible. It was so weird to be able to meet the guy and work with the guy who fucking made it possible for you, man, who inspired you, made you want to get up there and do it and whatnot. And George just kept giving me. And even in death, fucking George Carlin gave me. Because once George died, people started reconsidering Jersey Girl. Thank you so much. Thank you, George. I love you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce you to a man who's far better with words than I am. And we talked briefly about how to intro, and he was very darling because he goes, just make sure you end with my name. And I was like, wow, that's wild, because I was going to start with him and then, like, say a bunch of other shit. But then I was like, I should end with him. He's very smart. Ladies and gentlemen, he is a playwright, he is an author, and he is a humorist. And his name is Dylan Brody. Welcome. Beautiful.
Thank you. Kelly, Tony, thank you so much for letting me tell this story on this night. It is an honor to be here. In my early 30s, I began to fear that I simply wasn't funny enough to die young. Part of my understanding of the comedy world was that an early death was the surest route to immortality, certainly the quickest. And no one was comparing me to Lenny Bruce, and nobody was comparing me to Bill Hicks. And I started to shift my focus to my writing, to think about a literary legacy rather than a legacy of comedic potential unfulfilled. And right around this time, a friend made me aware that George Carlin was going to be at a party at a nightclub very near to my home in Studio City. So I took a chance. It wasn't a big chance that I took. It cost me nothing. I put a videotape of my stand-up reel in a manila envelope with a letter that said, you're one of my heroes, I love your work, I hope you'll enjoy some of mine. And I wrote on the envelope, for George Carlin, please hold for arrival. And I dropped it off at the nightclub. And on the way back to my car, I thought about how cool it was that George Carlin might watch my work on a television in the way that I had watched his work when I was a child. I adored him as a child. When I saw him on television, his rhythms were so natural, his jokes so conversational that I could instantly memorize an entire routine. And the next morning, I would recite them word for word over my syrup-soaked toaster waffles I remember my father saying, "That's not yours, Dylan. You didn't write that." 11 years old, I was learning about intellectual property rights. I would watch anything I thought might have George on it. I would lie on the floor of our cold upstate New York house with my head resting against Dusty, the great matted sheepdog mutt of my youth, through insufferable hours of Sonny and Cher and the Mac Davis When You're Hot, You're Hot show. Because I had seen George on Flip Wilson, and in my young mind, all comedy variety shows were probably pretty much the same thing, drawing from the same pool of talent. And when he didn't show up, Dusty would comfort me with his nose snuffling me. Dusty, let me say, never died. When I was about 15 or 16, he left home, and we thought he had gone off to the woods to die because we were told that's what dogs do. But then several months later, he came back, well-brushed and very clean. And my father called a number on a tag on his collar. And a man answered, and my father said, "Are you missing your dog?" And the man said, "No, my dog is lying next to me." And my father said, "Well, our dog just came home after apparently a lengthy vacation. And he had your number on his collar." And the man said, "Well, is your dog wearing a red collar?" And my father said, "Yes." And the man said, "Well, my dog lost a red collar a couple of months ago." So my father hypothesized that Dusty had mugged the man's dog, stolen his collar, and adopted the new identity to enter the underground dog revolutionary army. The man whose dog had lost the expensive collar was not amused by this. After a Milkbone, Dusty ran off again, but for the remainder of the time that we lived in that house, he would come back every few months looking well cared for. None of us has been back to Saratoga Springs for a long time now, but I am quite certain that Dusty is still there, this immortal dog wandering from home to home, finding new kids to raise and see off to school, and then finding a new place to live. But I digress. In 1998... in the summer, I had totally given up on my stand-up career. I was focused on my writing. I was sending in a submission to Late Night with David Letterman every week. And they responded positively, and they told me I was very talented, and they never offered me a job, and they never asked me for my social security number. And one afternoon, as I was spiraling into the late stages of early onset midlife crisis, the phone rang. And I picked it up. And a voice said, "Hi, Dylan, this is George Carlin." And I began to run through a Rolodex of friends who might adopt that identity as part of a prank. So I said, "Uh-huh." And the voice said, "Listen, I just looked at your tape. I'm sorry it took me so long. It's been sitting on top of my VCR for 6 months. Your cover letter was touching and sincere." And I said, "Holy shit, it's really you." Because I'm very cool. And George said, "Yeah." Anyway, I didn't think it was polite just to leave you hanging without at least picking up the phone. You're really very funny, and I thoroughly enjoyed looking at your work. I should have been thrilled to hear this. I'm thrilled now to know that I did hear this from my hero, but at the time I was sad and stoned, deeply despondent over the direction my career seemed to be going. So what I said was, "Yeah, great, would you mind telling the assholes at Letterman that?" And George said, "Oh, let me call you back." And my hero hung up on me. 7 minutes and 9 bong hits later, the phone rang again, and I picked it up. And George said, "All right, I called the woman I deal with over there when they book me. I told her you're a very funny young political comic and they should take you seriously. Is that okay?" It was. I said, "Are you kidding me? Yes, that's great. Yes." And he said, "All right then, well, take care and good luck with all of it, man. You're really very good." And he hung up again. I don't think I ever said thank you in this phone call. Here's the thing. It was a small thing for him to call me. It was a slightly larger thing for him to call Letterman on my behalf, but it cost him nothing. And it meant a great deal to me. As a young comic starting out, I believed that I could blaze my way into history with a six-gun wit. Now, walking the world, an adult, grown older than I ever believed I would be, it's become pretty clear to me that immortality is not earned with one-liners, no matter how clever they are. Immortality is earned with a generosity of spirit toward those around us. It's earned with a kind gesture. Immortality is earned with a cold nose on a sad night. Thank you.
That was brilliant. That was fantastic. Yeah. My nose is cold. Now listen, before I get into this next thing, I just want to, I'm not sure that you all are aware of it, but Tony Hendra, who is the gentleman who called to get me to come and do this, has written this magnificent book, and you can pick it up. It is here. So please make sure you get it, because it's worth the read. It's really quite fantastic, and I sent it to my mom, because she really digs Carlin. Listen, it's time to meet two people whose idea this tribute was. Miss Kelly Carlin, she's many things, a writer, performance artist, a personal life coach, a Jungian psychologist. I didn't know that. Well, I gotta talk to you. Most important, tonight is what it says on her website. She projects, protects. Child, please. She protects, cares for, and continues her father's legacy. You know I'm dyslexic, right? And Tony Hendra is an actor, comedian, editor, screenwriter. He's George's co-author. You may know him better as the cricket bat-wielding manager of Spinal Tap. But he's okay. So please welcome Kelly Carlin and Tony Hendra.
Hi, Dad. words. My dad, as you all know, loved words, so much so that he tortured me at times about them. More specifically, my whole life, almost up until the day he died, he used to do this little thing to me. We'd be at some event, either at the house or maybe in a party or in public somewhere, and at the end of the event or the evening, he would hand me a little sheet of paper with a word on it that somehow I had managed earlier in the day to completely mispronounce at some time. And it would be phonetically spelled out. And then he'd whisper to me the correct pronunciation. And one particular time it was, honey, it's conscious, not conscience. And the other one, which was kind of surprising to me and one that I still haven't adopted, it's short-lived, not short-lived. So there you go. There's a little education right there. The reason I bring up words is because my father was an author and a writer, and he really felt that he was a writer first, a performer second. But more specifically, he'd written three books. He'd written Brain Droppings, Napalm and Silly Putty, and the one that manages to piss off everyone in the world, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? Tony and I are now going to give you a little selection from these books.
Okay.
Yep. Men I can do without.
Men who have one long, uninterrupted eyebrow.
Men who give their genitals a name.
Women I can do without.
A crying woman with a harpoon gun entering a bar.
Any woman who repeatedly gives me the high five during sex.
Things you never see.
The Latin word for douchebag.
A mom-and-pop steel mill.
Condoms with pictures of the saints.
Oh, hello. The George Carlin Book Club.
How to milk a dog while it's sleeping.
How to make a small salad out of your work pants.
Eat, run, stay fit, and die anyway.
Fill your life with croutons.
Why Jews point.
The meaning of corn.
The doorway to Norway.
Short takes.
You can't fight City Hall, but you can goddamn sure blow it up.
You know, there ought to be at least one round state.
Nothing rhymes with nostril.
If you can't beat them, arrange to have them beaten.
Meow means woof in cat.
George Washington's brother was the uncle of our country.
I never liked a man I didn't meet. Work on it.
I recently bought a book of free verse for $12.
When I was a kid and a guy got killed in a Western, I always wondered who got his horse.
When Ronald Reagan got Alzheimer's, how could they tell?
There is now a Starbucks in my pants.
More people I can do without.
A dentist with blood in his hair.
People who know the third verse to the Star Spangled Banner.
Any lawyer who refers to the police as the federales.
More short takes.
Guys don't seem to be called lefty anymore.
You know the good part about all the executions in Texas? Fewer Texans.
Very few Germans know that in honor of her husband, Mrs. Hitler combed her pubic hair to one side.
When you step on the brakes, your life is in your foot's hands.
Electricity is really just organized lightning.
I always refer to any individual member of the Red Sox as a red sock. Is this correct?
Although it's untrue that rubbing a toad causes warts, it does give the toad a hard-on.
I think I am, therefore I am, I think.
As far as I can tell, jack shit and diddly squat are roughly the same amount.
A cat will blink when struck with a hammer.
I don't understand why prostitution is illegal. Selling is legal, fucking is legal. So why isn't selling fucking legal?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. As Whoopi mentioned, George's fourth and last book, Last Words, I was lucky enough to be the co-author on. And it was published last Christmas, just about 18 months after his death. But we started work on it in 1993. And the first task was what kind of book we were actually writing. And George didn't want to write an autobiography. He said only pinheaded criminal business pricks write autobiographies. We certainly, neither of us, wanted to espouse the effete Gallicism memoir, which we decided was a linguistic mongrel of me and mama. So we were searching around for a genre we were actually writing in, and because I was doing a certain amount of biography on this book and he was doing a certain amount of autobiography, we decided to split the difference and call it a sort of biography. And that's what we called it forever after. And it was a sort of biography in another way, because George never really wanted to tell the story of his life exactly. He wanted to tell, as he put it, the story of his art, how he went from a ninth grade dropout to a major artist and a major intellect, someone who I think merits the term our poet laureate of the ridiculous. And I always thought that calling George a comedian is kind of like calling B.B. King a guitarist. But in this culture, you know, comedy is rarely allowed into the elevated levels of art. Rodney Dangerfield famously said, "I don't get no respect as a comedian," but I think actually it's comedy that doesn't get any respect, unless you're 300 years old and French. So one of the reasons Kelly and I wanted to hold this tribute at this epicenter of arts and letters in our city was precisely that, to begin to acknowledge George's legacy to what he called the vulgar art. And so I would now like to introduce his much-loved brother to read from Last Words. It's chapter one, and it's about George's birth and conception. So would you please welcome to the stage Patrick Carlin.
Yeah, I got to stay near the mic, I know that. I want to thank you all for showing up for George, man. His vibes were everywhere today. I came down Riverside Drive just by accident. It just happened, you know. But that's how he is. He was always a weird guy, and he loved me with all his heart and soul. I'm going to keep this short and read this beautiful opening to this book. And I did it in the audio version, and I had a headset on when I did it, and it was really goofy to be saying words that I had said and words that I had hear him say. But anyway, here it is, kicking off. Sliding headfirst down a vagina with no clothes on and landing in the freshly shaven crotch of a screaming woman did not seem to be part of God's plan for me. At least not at first. I'm not one of those people who can boast of having but a sparkle in his mother's eye. Cinder comes closer. I was conceived in a damp, sand-flecked room at Curly's Hotel in Rockaway Beach, New York. August 1936, a headline in that Saturday's New York Post said, "Hot, sticky, rainy weekend begins. High humidity and temperatures in the 90s send millions to the beaches." At the Paramount Theater in Times Square, Bing Crosby and Francis Farmer starred in Rhythm on the Range. Mary and Patrick Carlin starred in yet another doomed Catholic remake of Rhythm in the Sack. Ah, for several generations, Rockaway Beach had been a favorite weekend retreat for New York's alcohol-crazed Irish youth in search of sun and sex. Popular ethnic slurs to the contrary, the Irish do enjoy sex. At least the last 10 seconds or so. But we must admit that Irish foreplay consists of little more than, "You awake?" Or the more caring, sensitive, "Brace yourself, Agnes." By the time my father's eager, whiskey-fueled sperm forced its way into my mother's Egg of the Month Club, she was 40, and he was 48, certainly old enough to be carrying rubbers. The odds against my future existence were even longer. This particular weekend was a single, isolated event during a marital separation that had lasted more than a year. Those things, this is paraphrasing, but they happened. Anyway, the separations were long because my father had trouble metabolizing alcohol. He drank, he got drunk, he hit people. Yeah. Their reconciliations were sudden because my father had a terrific line of bullshit and because my mother really loved him. So while I sprang from something good and positive, by the time I showed up, I was a distinct inconvenience. This marriage had gone south long before, as in Tierra del Fuego. Getting conceived had been hard enough. Staying conceived literally required a miracle. My next brush with non-existence came 2 months after the sweaty sex weekend in Rockaway Beach. During the 5 years between the birth of my brother and my tiny embryo glomming onto her uterine wall, my mother had made several visits to a certain Dr. Sunshine in Gramercy Square. Never, never, ever for an abortion, mind you. Holy Mary, Mother of God, no. The procedure in question was called a D&C. Dilation and curettage. Literally, open wide and scrape. Ah, yes, a wonderfully delicate euphemism for quasi-Catholics with a little money. I'll tell you, really high tone, too. Gramercy Park was the place to get opened wide and scraped. No back alley abortions on my father's salary. Legend has it that my mother was seated in Dr. Sunshine's waiting room with my father, who, being a family man, was reading the sports pages. Apparently just fine, with my being less than 100 feet from storm drain number 3. Ah, then it happened. My mother had a vision. Sometimes when you're trying to be born, that religious shit can come in handy. Yeah, not a full-blown vision like Jesus' face being formed by pubic hairs in the bottom of the shower, but real enough to save my embryonic ass. My mother claimed she saw the face of her dear dead mother in a painting on the waiting room wall. She took this as a certain sign of maternal disapproval from beyond the grave. Catholics go for that kind of shit. She jumped up and left the abortionist's office with me still safely in the oven. Ah, on the street below, she delivered these momentous words to my father. Pat, I'm gonna have this baby. That was it. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And George thanks all of you, man. And he really is around. And I'm not a spook job or anything like that. I don't see him. But but I definitely hear him, and I got his vibes. And he's having a wonderful evening with all of you showing up here. Thank you. And thank you.
That's my uncle. I have a little story. I am a writer and a performer also, and I just wrote this recently, and it's a nice segue into our next segment. This is a true story. It's about when I was a kid. 1972 was quite a summer. Everything had changed. Only a few years earlier, my dad had been a clean-cut, thin-tied, suit-wearing guy who was opening for the Supremes in Vegas and doing spots on the Ed Sullivan Show. He was making a great living, working clean. Now in 1972, his hair was down past his shoulders, tie-dyed shirts and denim jeans were his fashion staple, and he was headlining at almost every college campus in America. He was now making a great living at what some call working blue. Although her family was now officially part of the counterculture, my mother still wanted her American dream home. So that summer, we moved from a small apartment in Venice Beach, where we had been surrounded by our people, hippies, bikers, and freaks, and into a huge modern house atop a hill in Pacific Palisades, where we were now surrounded by someone else's people. Rand Corporation executives, a National Security Council bigwig, and lots of Governor Reagan's fans. Although Venice had been a really rough neighborhood, in some ways it felt safer to me. At least our freakiness blended in. Now it felt like our freakiness could possibly lead to Nixon's enemies list. I remember during the first month we lived in the Palisades, there was some sort of party across the street with men in suits and women in cocktail dresses mingling on the lawn. I guess they were the Rand executives. My dad and I were in the front yard, and in a large, booming voice, he said to me, "Hey, Kelly, look at those assholes over there." Heads turned, bodies bristled, and I wanted to disappear. An alarm went off inside of me, and I suddenly felt very, very unsafe. Recently, my dad had become more and more antagonistic to those on the other side. It was fueling him artistically and politically, but nonetheless, it was making me very nervous. 1972 was quite a year in general, because as you all remember, the country was very divided. Lines were firmly drawn, and sides were vehemently chosen. Freaks versus straights. Heads versus blockheads. In June, after I got out of school, my mom and I joined my dad on the road. One of our first stops was Kent State in Ohio. All I remember from that day was my dad showing me some makeshift memorial and telling me that some students had been shot and killed during a protest a few years earlier. My dad always wanted me to understand the importance of people who stood up for what they believed in, and especially those who were willing to stand up to their government to make their point. It seems that many of Dad's lessons back then were about getting me to understand how the government had always tried to silence those who did not have a voice to begin with, in particular, blacks and the Native Americans. Now he was saying young white American girls and boys were in that category too. Being an only child and one who was increasingly needing to be more mature than my years due to the chaos of the 70s, I acted nonchalant and calm about this news he was telling me, trying to show my dad that I understood the lessons of civics and morality that he was trying to teach me. But my calm veneer was just that. What was really going on inside of me was that alarm that seemed to be going off inside of me more and more those days. Somewhere inside of me was the question, if they were shooting these people, why wouldn't they shoot my dad? A few weeks later, we were in Milwaukee. My dad was hired to work at Summerfest, basically an ocean of beer with an island of sausage in the middle of it. You know what they call good, clean American outdoor fun. By this time, my dad was doing his new routine, filthy words. It's where he was actually examining, in a somewhat scholarly fashion, the usage of language in our culture, more particularly the usage of the words shit and fuck. Now, this Summerfest was, like I said, an outdoor venue where the main stage act could be heard in a very large vicinity. So there was my dad on stage, killing. Most of the audience loved it. And there were Mom and I backstage enjoying the show. And then suddenly the promoter comes up to my mom and says, "The cops are here. They're complaining about the language, and they're going to arrest George the minute he walks off stage." I guess when my dad said that he would like to fuck everyone in the audience, the nice Midwest policeman just didn't see the humor in that. Knowing that my dad was carrying drugs in his pocket, grass and coke, my mom thought fast, grabbed a glass of water, and walked out onto stage. Dad, confused, took the water, and Mom quietly told him to exit stage left soon. The cops were closing in on stage right. Dad wrapped it up, left stage left, and we all quickly hustled into the dressing room where the doors were locked, drugs were stashed, and plans were hatched. The promoter was trying to keep things calm when, bang, the sound of a gun went off. I became hysterical, my mom grabbed me, and then nothing happened. It was a balloon. Someone had popped a balloon. Everyone laughed a nervous laugh, but I was now emotionally undone. Before I knew it, the door was open, my dad walked out, and within a few seconds, policemen cuffed him. Now terrified that I would never, ever see him again, I clung to my mother's body. After a while, she calmed me down enough so that she could leave to find a First Amendment lawyer to help my dad get out of jail. I went home with the promoter to his house and family, where I spent the rest of the weekend distracting myself by swimming with his kids in something that, as a Southern California girl, I had never seen before, an above-ground pool. Dad got bail, we reunited, and the fight went on. A few weeks later, we were in New York, my dad's city, this city, with an audience that would have loved to be collectively fucked by him. He opened to a sell-out crowd at Carnegie Hall. I remember the thrill of hearing the chants, "George, George, George." We were back on safe territory. By the end of that summer in 1972, although the lines may have been drawn and the sides chosen, there was a wave now, an unstoppable momentum to the movement that my father and thousands of others were riding. Change was happening. And although I was just a child who was definitely traumatized by some of those events, I'm also very proud to have been a witness to the courage that it takes to speak one's truth and have your voice heard, especially today in 2010, when once again, everything is changing. Here's my dad's words.
Yeah, there are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. You know the 7, don't you, that you can't say on television? Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits, huh? Those are the heavy 7. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war. Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. Wow. And tits doesn't even belong on the list, you know? Yeah. It's such a friendly sounding word. Sounds like a nickname, right? Hey, tits, come in, man. Hey, tits. Sounds like a snack, doesn't it, huh? New Nabisco tits. The new cheese tits. And corn tits and pizza tits and sesame tits, onion tits, tater tits. Yeah. Bet you can't eat just one. But you can understand why some of them are there. I mean, I'm not completely insensitive to people's feelings. You know, I can dig why some of those words got on the list. Like cocksucker and motherfucker, those are heavyweight words, you know. Oh, there's a lot going on there, man. Besides the literal translation and the emotional feeling, I mean, they're just busy words. There's a lot of syllables to contend with. And those K's, those are aggressive sounds. They jump out at you, man. Cocksucker, motherfucker, cocksucker. It's like an assault on you, you know? So I can dig that. Now, we mentioned shit earlier, of course, and 2 of the other 4-letter Anglo-Saxon words are piss and cunt, which go together, of course, but forget that. Little accidental humor I throw there. Piss and cunt. The reason that piss and cunt are on the list is that a long time ago, certain ladies said, those are the 2 I'm not going to say. I don't mind fucking shit, but P and C are out.
PNC are out. Which led to such stupid sentences as, okay, you fuckers, I'm going to tinkle now. Of course, the word fuck. The word fuck. I don't really, well, there's some more accidental humor. I don't really want to get into that now. Because I think it takes too long. But I do mean that. I mean, I think the word fuck is a very important word. It's the beginning of life, and yet it's a word we use to hurt one another quite often. And people much wiser than I have said, I'd rather have my son watch a film with two people making love than two people trying to kill one another. And I, of course, can agree. It's a great sentiment. I wish I knew who said it first, and I agree with that. But I'd like to take it a step further. I'd like to substitute the word fuck for the word kill in all those movie cliches we grew up with, right? Okay, Sheriff, we're gonna fuck you now. But we're gonna fuck you slow.
As you know, those words still can't be said on television. I've tried. But now they charge you $375,000 if you say it during, like, the show that I do. And every place that it's being broadcast at that time, you are fined for. So if you're on in six or seven different places, you're fined $375,000. So since I'm not Oprah, I didn't want to chance it, really. But those seven words made George the only American comedian whose work resulted in a major Supreme Court ruling, the FCC versus Pacifica. Our next guest is the perfect person to take stock of that. Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said of him that he is the most significant First Amendment lawyer of our age. He is also, as it turns out, a George Carlin fan. Please welcome Floyd Abrams.
I'll do it with this one. Thank you all very much. I never knew George Carlin. What I did know was his work in the way that all of you in this audience have come to know his work. And it only occurred to me in preparing to say a few words tonight that the piece of that George Carlin did that I came to remember the most for a number of years was a piece so innocent compared to everything we've heard tonight. So lacking in any of the language which led, as I'll come in a moment, to the Supreme Court case, that it's worth just recalling his enormous facility with words, his enormous focus in a way that other people didn't have long before he started to get famous in part because of the blue language. And that was his piece about baseball and football. I'm not going to do it, but I've remembered it so long for so many years. It's the depiction, for those of you that don't recall it, of baseball as this bucolic sport, outdoors, relaxed, friendly, cheerful, and football as war. Whoever noticed before George Carlin that in football they wear helmets and in baseball they wear caps? Whoever noticed at the same time that in football you get a penalty, in baseball you make an error? who noticed that in football you have a 2-minute warning, in baseball you have a 7th-inning stretch? And whoever noticed, and this one I want to read to you, at the end of his piece about this, he said unforgettably about football, "The object is for the quarterback, also known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use shotgun, and that in baseball, the object is to go home and to be safe." Well, that was the George Carlin that I remember first, and in a sense, still best. And it was necessary for him as an artist, necessary to move beyond that. That was enormously perceptive. It's perceptive about the games. It's perceptive about words. It's perceptive in its way about the country. But he needed to do more. And he needed to use the sort of words which ultimately led to the great and sad Supreme Court case involving Pacifica. The case, you may recall, arose in the early 1970s. The piece that you've seen a little bit of had been on records, and it was broadcast at 2 p.m. one weekday on WBAI, a Pacifica-owned station. A man who was very active in a search for bad words on radio and television, active in a group called Morality in Media, was driving with his 15-year-old son when WBIA broadcast that which you've just heard, and they broadcast all 12 minutes of it. A complaint was filed with the FCC. The FCC concluded that there were statutes on the books which not only banned obscenity, don't ask me for definitions tonight, but banned obscenity, but on television and radio went beyond obscenity and did so in a way that allowed broadcasting to be subjected to an entirely different regime than existed anywhere else and in any other media. And so when filthy words, quote unquote, appeared on WBAI, it was said to be indecent, not obscene, but indecent. And for the first time, the FCC rendered a ruling saying that those words, the use of those words in that way, was indecent. And that was the case that went to the Supreme Court. And by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said, yes, it was indecent, and yes, that it was constitutional. It did not violate the First Amendment for the statute to say that and for the FCC to make that ruling. The opinion for the court was written by Justice Stevens, now a sort of liberal icon, but who has never been in front of the line in terms of defending the First Amendment. And I wanted to read you the first paragraph of Justice Stevens' opinion to show you his description of what this is about. Quote, "A satiric humorist named George Carlin recorded a 12-minute monologue entitled Filthy Words before a live audience in a California theater. He began by referring to his thoughts about, quote, the words you couldn't say in public, on the airways, the ones, I'm reading it as written, not spoken, which is what you've just heard, the ones you definitely wouldn't say ever, unquote. He proceeded to list those words and to repeat them over and over again in a variety of colloquialisms. The transcript of the recording indicates frequent laughter from the audience, unquote. Just compare those dead words to the language, the explosive language, the humor, the wit, the perception, and the seriousness of Carlin in using the seven words to talk about everything, about how words shouldn't lead to suppression, and about how we go so far off base in banning words and banning certain types of speech. Justice Stevens' opinion for the court had a lot of passages, which I will spare you. It's really based on the notion that the program was on at 2 in the afternoon. Radio and television are different than books, magazines, newspapers, records, because they're so pervasive in American society, it's hard, maybe impossible, to escape them. And he wound up answering the dissenting opinion, which I will read a paragraph from, the opinion of Justice Brennan. He wound up answering that by saying, quote, Pacifica's broadcast could have enlarged a child's vocabulary in an instant. Justice Brennan, and how we miss him, dissented from the opinion. And he dissented in a particularly sophisticated way, in a way that really goes beyond in philosophy and in thoughtfulness what many Supreme Court opinions do in the First Amendment area or elsewhere. He said that the court's balance fails to accord proper weight to the interest of listeners who wish to hear broadcasts the FCC deems offensive. It permits majoritarian tastes completely to preclude a protected message from entering the homes of a receptive, unoffended minority. Justice Brennan argued that the decision had the very opposite impact that the majority claimed, since it actually reduced the options available to a parent. Well, 5-4 opinion, the Supreme Court had decided. With what result? Well, the FCC had sort of promised the court in their briefs and in their opinions, that they would interpret a victory very narrowly. And for almost 25 years, they did. They did not take a broad view of what could be deemed indecent. Indeed, the view that they took sometimes sounded as if you had to use all seven words in a row to be inconsistent with what the law did not protect. But then, in the Bush years, the later Bush years, the FCC changed. Maybe the attitudes of the American public changed, but certainly the membership of the FCC changed. And we started down the road that Whoopi Goldberg has told you about. Fines of individual stations, not of a network, but every station in the network, of $375,000 a shot for indecent material on television. It got to the point where over 60 PBS stations refused to show Saving Private Ryan for fear that the use of the words of the GIs in that movie would lead to enormous, paralyzing, and indeed for public television, destructive fines. As we meet today, there are two cases in the courts which will have a lot to say about whether what George Carlin believed in will ultimately be vindicated. One of them arose at the Golden Globe Awards for NBC when Bono accepted an award And to quote him, because I don't want to lose the special flavor of what the court referred to, and I love the phrase, as a fleeting expletive. He's given the award, and on live television, he says, "This is really, really fucking brilliant." For that, a broadcaster has been in court now for over 4 years, has spent an enormous amount of money, has been to the Supreme Court once. The case is now pending. It was just argued a few months ago in the Court of Appeals, federal court here in New York. The language is strikingly similar to the vice president's language referred to a few minutes ago, which in this small audience, just for us, I will read to you that he whispered in the president's ear yesterday as the president signed the health reform bill, "This is a big fucking deal." The other case is the wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl. How many years ago was that? I mean, do you believe that case is still in the court? And in that case, CBS has been fighting for years not to have the principle established that that mini-second of I could never see Janet Jackson's breast, but it was there. But in that mini second, that if that ever happened again, at least, would be $375,000 a peak per station around the country, something which would destroy live television broadcasts. And indeed, I mean, have you noticed C-SPAN doesn't broadcast live things anymore? C-SPAN has a hold for a few seconds, the same way entertainment shows or other shows do, because of these cases, because of the FCC's decision, and because ultimately of the Supreme Court's error in the case involving the FCC and Pacifica, that all started with a great piece of humor and philosophy by George Carlin. I think it'll get better in these two cases at least, and I think we all have a lot to thank George Carlin for being willing to take the lead in trying to open up the areas of communication so we can all hear or not hear, see or not see, that material as we like. Thank you very much.
Before I introduce our last guest, I just wanted to say a few things, one of which was, my dad got such a thrill knowing that his whole routine was typed out verbatim into the Supreme Court records. And that someone in front of the justices actually read shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, and tits. It was one of the biggest joys of his life. It was. And I'd also just want to take a moment to thank Tony Hendra especially, and Paul, and everyone at the New York Public Library, and all of you, all of our guests for speaking about my father so beautifully, and all of you who came tonight to join us. Thank you so much for being here. Yes, give yourself a round of applause. And I just wanted to say a public thank you to the world of comedy, who has taken me into their heart since my father died. And you may think comedians are crazy, they are, but they got huge hearts. And so I just want to publicly thank all of the world of comedy, who's really brought me into the family. Thank you so, so much. Our last guest, like others, our last guest is an all-rounder, actor, comedian, Emmy Award-winning writer, filmmaker. He is ranked number 98 on Comedy Central's 100 Greatest Stand-Ups of All Time. But what the fuck do they know? For us, he's number one tonight, Louis C.K.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm really honored to be here. I'm happy just to be here as a ticket holder, just to watch everything that's happened. The Stiller family, and that was crazy, and Kevin, and the guy that looks like Dick Cheney at the end there. A very, very nice version of Dick Cheney. He's not a lizard, I don't think. But I think I can just tell you what George is. I'm a comedian, and I do what he did. And he was the first person I knew that I knew what comedy was. Children love to laugh, but most people that make children laugh for a living suck at it. Clowns aren't funny. That doesn't exist, a funny clown. If a person was funny, they'd do comedy because you make money doing it. No clowns. There's no HBO clown specials if you make a bunch of money. So clowns suck. And kids just look at them and just go, just please stop trying to make me laugh. There's nothing worse than a person who's not funny trying to be funny, and that's what a clown is. A guy waiting for a bus is funnier than a shit clown at a kid's party. So, but kids need to laugh, so the first time you really laugh means a lot to you. And I remember my first big, like, grown-up feeling laugh, and I saw George Carlin on Saturday Night Live, and he said, what do dogs do on their day off? They can't lay around. That's their job. And I just, something went off, and I just couldn't stop laughing. And the idea was born in my head at that moment. I want to be funny. I want to be a comedian. I didn't know that a grown person could be a comedian. That's an incredible thing to me. And I had other heroes, Richard Pryor, Steve Martin, Bill Cosby, but George was like me. He was an East Coast Catholic, you know, I had something to identify with him. And the first time I remember getting a laugh, I was in fourth grade, and they asked the class, the teacher said, there are three bones in the skull. Name one. And I said, the noggin. And I got a big laugh. And I thought, hey, you know, I could do this. I could be like George. So I started doing stand-up. Didn't go to college, didn't pursue anything else professionally, really. Started doing stand-up. First time I went on stage, I did a minute and a half, and I bombed. It was terrible. But I wanted it so badly that I kept trying, and I learned how to write jokes. And I just had jokes, kind of funny thoughts. And about 15 years later, I had been going in a circle that didn't take me anywhere. Nobody gave a shit who I was, and I didn't either. I honestly didn't. I used to hear my act and go, this is shit, and I hate it. But I've been doing this for 15 years, and stopping now is like getting out of prison. Like, what do you do after 15 years of stand-up comedy? How do you re-enter the workforce? So I was in a really bad place. I hated my act. I've been doing the same hour of comedy for 15 years, and it was shit, I promise you. And I was working places like Chinese restaurants. And I'd do a show in a Chinese restaurant where they don't even know there's a show going to happen. They're there to eat. And all of a sudden you'd go, hey, everybody. And people are like, I'm eating. I don't want to be forced to sit in this. So I was doing a Chinese restaurant called the Kowloon in Boston. It's Saugus, Massachusetts. And I was sitting in my car after the show just feeling like, This was all a big mistake. I'm not good enough. And I felt like my jokes were a trap. And I listened to a CD of George talking about comedy and the workshopping it and talking about it seriously. And the thing that blew me away about this fellow was that he just kept putting out specials. Every year there'd be a new George Carlin special, a new George Carlin album. They just kept coming, and each one was deeper than the next. And I just thought, how can he do that? And it made me literally cry that I could never do that. I was telling the same jokes for 15 years. So I'm listening, and they ask him, how do you do all this material? And I'm like, And I hear him, and he says, well, I just decided every year I'd be working on that year's special. And I'd do the special, and then I'd just chuck out the material. And I'd start again with nothing. And I thought, that's crazy. How do you throw away? It took me 15 years to build this shitty hour. If I throw it away, I got nothing. But he gave me the courage to try. And also, I was desperate. What the fuck else was I going to do? This idea that you throw everything away and you start over again. And I thought, well, okay, when you're done telling jokes about airplanes and dogs, and you throw those away, what do you got left? You can only dig deeper. Start talking about your feelings and who you are. And then you do those jokes and they're gone. You got to dig deeper. So then you start thinking about your fears and your nightmares and doing jokes about that. And then they're gone. And then you start going into just weird shit. Yeah, eventually you get to your balls. But there's a whole... It's a process that I watched him do my whole life, and I started to try to do it. And I started to think, what do I... Because he says whatever he wants. What do I really want to say that I'm afraid to say? And at the time, I was a father. I am still a father. But at the time, I had started... I didn't take off yet. The jury's out. My oldest is 8. I could still split. So far, I'm still there. I was having a lot of hard time being a father. And I wanted to say it on stage. And one night I thought, okay, forget all the old jokes. I'm going to start again. And I thought of the first thing. I said, I can't have sex with my wife, because we have a baby, and our baby's a fucking asshole. It's just what I was feeling, and I said it. And the audience went, whoa! And I thought, oh, I'm somewhere new now. And I said... And I said something like, I never used to get babies in the garbage, but now I understand it. And they did that. And I thought, I'd rather have that than the shit tepid laughter for my 15-year-old jokes. So I started going down this road. And he was always the beacon for me, always, this guy. He always gave me the courage. He says, you know, the line that Kevin quoted, where he said people that abortion rallies are usually anti-abortion rallies are people you wouldn't want to fuck in the first place. He opened a special with that at Carnegie Hall. He comes out on stage. You have to watch it, and he doesn't milk the crowd for applause. They're applauding, and he goes, they're all going, George, and he goes, yeah. I got to get this out. You ever notice the people anti-abortion rallies are people you want to fuck in the first place? And most comedians would do, like, you know, a good half an hour of really sweet material and couch that joke in a lot of... But he just had to get it out there. So he set that example for me. And that's the way I've done my act. And since then, I've done 3 comedy specials. And I've started down the same road. It's been a massive change for me. I feel every year I've got something to work for. The same... I'm doing exactly what he taught me to do, and on stage I feel a courage to say what I want to say because of this guy. And anyway, a few years ago, I was about to tape my second stand-up special, and he was taping the same night in L.A. He taped his last special on the same night that I taped one, and I remember feeling like, this is amazing that I do what this great man does, and that we do it in the same way. And he... died, and kicked me in the balls when he died. It really hurt. And then I remember that, and I don't want to be doing this, I'm sorry, but later I was at a whatever, it doesn't matter, and my phone rang, and it was his daughter, it was Kelly, and I have 2 kids, and they're girls, so I thought, he's got a daughter, and his daughter is calling me, and I know what it means to have a daughter, because I have 2, and she's calling me and asking me to come and say something about what he meant to me. So that was a big moment for me. I'm very proud to do what George did. I know I was supposed to close funny, but I'm not good at doing stuff that isn't my act, so I'm sorry. But he was a great man, and anything that ever happens to me that's good is due to this guy. And I can tell you, because I do what he did, that it was really hard to say the shit that he did, and that it took a lot of courage. It was difficult. So thanks for coming and honoring him, and thanks for having me.
We just have a little moment of goodbye for you.
Thanks for being here with me for a little while tonight.
Thank you all very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.